Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast 127. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I'm looking at a few things. I'm looking at what I've been watching recently in a little more detail than I usually do. And I'm also going to talk about the Netflix science fiction TV series Altered Carbon, which I binged the day it came out. So we're going to be looking at some deep cyberpunk stuff, which is very transgressive in some ways and a little bit controversial in others. Then I'm going to be talking about a whole bunch of genre material that I've been watching since the last time I recorded. So let me get the contact details out of the way and we can get the show started. The Martian Drive-In Podcast appears every 2 weeks. It's a podcast of science fiction, horror, and fantasy movie appreciation, and sometimes television. It doesn't matter if it's old or new, good or bad, black or white or colour. As long as I like it, it may show up here. There are also occasional roundtables where I get together a group of like-minded people and we discuss a particular topic of interest to genre film nerds. You can support the podcast by donating at patreon.com/paleocinema. You can keep up with podcast news at the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can leave reviews on iTunes and send MP3 or written feedback to cultguru@gmail.com. That's cult with a K. This podcast may contain adult discussions, so don't listen to it in the car while driving the kids to school. Okay, so how has everybody been? The job of moving all the shit out of the bag cave has started. I'd say I'm about maybe 1/6 done with that. There are a few bags of stuff gone out and some things that we're going to give away or sell. But there's at least a little more kind of walking space in the man cave for me to move around and get things done. And I found some very cool things that I've forgotten I had. I'm not going to go into details of what they are because that would take the whole podcast. But nonetheless, it's a good thing that I'm doing. Though I haven't really been hitting it hard. I'm kind of happy with the progress so far. There is more work to be done, of course. And once everything is fixed, I will be posting pictures on the internet. I'm going to be kind of proud of it. I'm getting a few new bookshelves. There's a ton of stuff to do here. But I'm determined to get it done in the next couple of months, maybe. By the way, I'm actually recording this part of the podcast at 4:39 on a Sunday morning, which is a little bit unusual. I usually do it later in the day. It's quiet now, I'm up, and therefore I'm doing it. And having said that, it is now Sunday afternoon. I went off and did other things, slept and did some stuff, but so it's now Sunday afternoon, not very early on Sunday morning. So I did say I was going to, with this podcast, talk about the things I have been watching apart from Altered Carbon, which is the main focus of the podcast. So let's see. There's been a few interesting things, including, and I'm going to play some trailers for you, including this.
Beneath the city of New York are living catacombs, an endless maze of subterranean tunnels, unfit for anything human. Unauthorized for anything experimental.
Hold it! There's something moving up ahead at the top!
And unlikely to bring anyone down there. So, they're coming up. Chud! Chud! Check your basement. And your bathroom. Keep off the street. And try to hide. But remember, the dark is their place. The night is their time. And tomorrow, the only things living in the city of New York will be Chud. Chud. Cannibalistic, humanoid, underground dwellers. Chud. They're not staying down there anymore.
Yes, I watched Chud for the first time probably since VHS days, and I enjoyed it. It's not perfect. It's very much a 1980s synth soundtracked, rubber-suited monster kind of movie, but the cast was kind of cool. We had John Hurt, who recently died, unfortunately, Daniel Stern, Kim Grist, who was in Brazil, Terry Gilliam's Brazil, with Jonathan Pryce, and a few other people. Frankie Faison's in there. John Goodman and Jay Thomas turn up as a couple of cops that soon get eaten by the Chuds. And yeah, it kind of worked for me. I enjoyed it. I don't think that it was particularly well edited, but apart from that, it's very much a driving kind of movie. One of those movies that was generated partly because there was that enormous hunger for product in video stores in the 1980s, 1990s. And so pretty much anything would get made and anything would find an audience. So that was kind of cool. And I really enjoyed watching that as a nostalgia kick. And there was, of course, a sequel called Chud 2 Bud the Chud, which I may well seek out and watch at some stage, but not right now. It's a nice nostalgia kick, and if you haven't seen it for a while, it may well be something that you want to take a look at. It was made by a director called Douglas Cheek, which is a kind of unfortunate name, on a $1.25 million budget. Came out in 84, and it made 4.7, so they definitely got some money back on it. The locations are good. They have a whole bunch of homeless people in there without being kind of looking down on them, which is a bit unusual for a lot of films at that time, where homeless people were the butt of comedy. But in this one case, it doesn't happen that way. And that's kind of honest and fair by the filmmakers, and I appreciated that one. Yeah, so I started doing that. And then the other thing, I'll talk about something else I did, which isn't directly a movie. I put Plex on my big donk PVC, the one that I am currently recording on, the one with the big engine and the big hard drive and all of the graphics cards and all the groovy stuff that makes podcasting and video editing possible. And I'm now running it from there to my Xbox in the other room and the big television. So what I've got now is something like 1,700 movies on a hard drive, which I can then stream in the other room anytime I like using Plex. I don't know why I didn't do it earlier. I think I tried Plex out very early in the piece when I didn't have any way of particularly linking it to a television set. I had a way of linking it to my other laptops, but not to a TV set. So I was kind of looking for a way to do a media server for the house, and this turned out to be the way to do it. And I've nearly filled up a 3 terabyte hard drive with movies and TV shows and things like that, so that's going to take up some of my time at the moment. Did I mention this at the start of the podcast? Hang on. No, actually I didn't. I mentioned it last time I did Paleo Cinema. I'm currently in the middle of going through what they call a Prep Kit C. You never want to do a Prep Kit C, believe me, because a Prep Kit C is the thing that you've got to have before you get a colonoscopy. It's 3 different lots of liquid you've got to have spaced out about 12 hours apart in 3 groups, and you've got to drink a lot of it. The first one's 200 milliliters, second one's a full liter over an hour, and the third one's another 200 milliliters, and it is horrible. It tastes bad and bitter. It basically nukes your guts clean. And before that, I had to go on a diet for 2 days of only eating white food. So I could have rice, I could have steamed fish and steamed chicken, I could have white bread, and that's about it. I can drink some liquid, so I can have coffee, fortunately, and a few other things, but I haven't had a decent meal in a couple of days now. So if I go a little bit wobbly recording this podcast, bear with me, okay? It's not my fault. It's medical. Not that there's anything wrong with me medically. They just said they wanted to do a checkup about 18 months after my last one. And so I said, okay. And indeed, they have done that. So tomorrow being Monday, I'm off to get knocked out while they basically do an alien abduction thing on my intestines. It's not an unpleasant thing, really. They give you a needle and then you wake up. So that's kind of cool. I'm fascinated with anesthesia because of that, you know, the world goes on while you're not there kind of thing. It's kind of an interesting phenomenon and an interesting feeling, but I don't ever feel scared about it because I just let things roll off my back with that kind of stuff. So if I'm a little bit odd, and if it sounds like I recorded this podcast in chunks, I did, because the reason for that is that I may need to rush out to the men's room, putting it politely, a little bit during the podcast recording. So there we go. Let's get back to movies. Second movie I saw was one I saw ages and ages ago, and I kind of like it. It's directed by William Castle, but it's one of the most obscure William Castle movies, a 1968 movie called Project X, which is deeply science fictional. It stars Christopher George. It's got Henry Jones in it. Monty Markham turns up, Harold Gould, Philip Pine. So a whole bunch of character actors. And it's about a guy called Hagen Arnold, who in the about 150 years from then, future, what is it, 2118, so 100 years from now, he's come back from Sino-Asia, which is a monolithic communist kind of place run by the Chinese. And all he can remember is that the West is going to be destroyed in so many days. So they put him in cryogenic suspension and get him out and try to find out what exactly is happening with it. It's very high-tech, and for the time, it's quite advanced. And William Castle and the writers Leslie Davis and Edmund Morris do an okay job on a limited budget of giving us a really weird future. It's one of those 1960s futures, though, where women wear miniskirts and the machinery, the computers are all great big things with flashing lights on them, and they have groovy things like human brains in big bowls which they can then get information from, all that kind of stuff. So that's kind of interesting and a bit bold for the time. The other interesting thing is that there's a bunch of stuff where they're diving into the character of Hayden Arnold's memory, and they see his memories up on a screen. And most of it, with a little bit of exception, is Hanna-Barbera animation. So there's these groovy things with a futuristic city and guys running through a futuristic city in China, all of which is done by Hanna-Barbera using production design and artwork by Alex Toth. So it's very cool from that point of view. And if you're a Hanna-Barbera fan, you've got to see Project X for that reason. It really does work. It's very much of its time, and it's a little bit shy the way that 1960s science fiction was, and apologetic, because science fiction in those days wasn't the genre it is now, which is flavor of the month for the last 10 years. Or maybe it's more like 20 years. So nonetheless, it's of its time, but I kind of enjoyed watching it. And if you're a William Castle completist, you've got to see Project X. So that's the second thing. Unfortunately, I couldn't find a trailer for it, but look for it out there. It is available. I know it was released about 10 years ago on disc, so you should be able to find a copy of it if you really want to. And while we're talking about human brains in glass jars, I also saw this movie this week.
Lou Ayres, as the scientist who discovered that the human brain can survive bodily destruction, can continue to function as a dynamo of living thought, generating a mental power greater than the science of man. Gene Evans, as his assistant, sharing the burden of a terrifying knowledge with ever-increasing fear and hatred.
Step back!
Mr. Donovan intends to dominate the international financial scene. And a fatal accident will occur to all who happen to stand in his way.
Steve Brody is the reporter who probed too deeply into the beyond and received the full impact of its deadliest forces.
Yoakum's death was no accident. Donovan engineered it.
And the same thing could happen to us. Donovan could kill us the same way he killed Yoakum.
That's right. And it's too dangerous to wait any longer.
Frank!
Surprised? Thanks to Dr. Patrick Corey, Donovan's brain will live, thrive, and continue to grow far beyond the body of Dr. Corey. It is already able to exist in any body, anywhere it will. Knowing this, you now know too much.
Nancy Davis, as the woman who was compelled to submit to the brain's satanic vibrations of evil.
Yep, it's a 1953 black and white science fiction film, Donovan's Brain, starring Lou Ayres, as it says, and one of the worst actresses to get major starring roles in Hollywood history, Nancy Davis, who later went on to be Nancy Reagan. But if you have a look, this is an interesting movie from not only the point of view of it's about keeping alive the brain of a millionaire who takes over the people around him while he's a brain in a tank. Apart from that, if you see Donovan's Brain, watch Nancy Davis / Reagan's acting, particularly when other people are talking, because she's one of those actors that doesn't look like they're listening. It looks like she looks like she's waiting, which is the worst thing you can do as an actor. Rather than taking on or appearing to take on what the other person is saying, she's got this blank expression on her face until it's her turn to talk. And that's death for any kind of acting. And for the actors who are talking when she's listening, not getting that kind of non-verbal feedback reduces their art, in a sense. So I found that really interesting to watch from that point of view. Then I went out to watch the previous version of this, a movie called The Lady and the Monster, which was made back in 1944. It starred Richard Arlen and Eric von Stroheim playing the scientist who gets the brain into the jar, and an actor called Vera Ralston, also known as Vera Ruber-Ralston, who was a Czech figure skater and actress. So basically, they've got a horror movie with a figure skater in it. One of the unfortunate things about this is that Vera Ralston had a thick accent. Now, that by itself isn't necessarily an impediment to a career, but she couldn't act. That was the other side of it. So both versions of this movie, the first two versions, the 1944 version and the 1953 version, had protagonist females who just simply couldn't act, which is a big problem. There was a 1960 version that the British did called The Brain. I'm just looking that up, as you can hear from the typing. And that one plays a bit better. It's got Anne Haywood for a start, who's a fine actor. It's got Freddie Francis directing it. Who else is in there? Peter Van Eyck, Cecil Parker, Bernard Lee, who played M in the old early James Bond films. Maxine Audley's in there. Miles Mallison turns up. Alan Cuthbertson, John Junkin, Patsy Rowland. So, yeah, I'm going to actually grab that one and watch it, because I'm going to be a completist on the versions of Donovan's Brain. So watching the two that I did see, Donovan's Brain and The Lady and the Monster. By the way, The Lady and the Monster isn't really good, apart from Eric von Stroheim being menacing. It doesn't have a lot working for it. Nonetheless, it was a bit of fun to kind of revisit what might be considered classic science fiction films. And so I grooved on that a little bit, and it was a little bit of fun. So then I decided to stay on the roll and went with Earth vs. the Spider from 1958, starring Ed Kemmer, whose only claim to fame, really, is that he was in a TV series in the early 1950s called Space Patrol. I'll play you the trailer and let you know what I like and don't like about this movie.
What's that noise?
Spiders. I told them to bring me one, and I'd believe it.
Well, I can't say I blame you, Sheriff.
But Flynn's still missing.
Deep into caverns whose very air is putrefied by the stench of death, they search ceaselessly for a missing man, or possibly a giant spider no one really believes exists, except the high school teacher who knows his science and his students.
There'll be more giant spiders coming into the world. They may even be hatching from their eggs in some remote spot right now. Do you realize how easy it would be for them to overcome us humans?
A horrifying spectacle. Its existence shocks and fascinates the world of science. Its gigantic claws capable of crushing a man, or tearing a woman apart as if she were a fly. But nothing sends the cats like the presence of out-of-this-world horror. A heart-stopping experience that defies man's imagination. The that shrinks every woman's skin with the tension of terrifying withdrawal, as if 1,000 spiders were taking possession of her body. You'll never believe it until you see it. You'll never forget the touch of the spider.
Earth vs. the Spider is kind of entertaining. The giant spider effects, of course, are filmed with using a real tarantula on kind of miniature sets and things like that. But it kind of has fun, and they've got some really absurd things in there that make it a little bit more of a joy than it would have been otherwise. Things like they think they've killed the spider, so they put it in a high school gymnasium, and a bunch of kids end up practicing for a rock and roll concert, you know, kind of dancing and grooving to the music, while there's a giant spider, which they're fairly sure but not entirely convinced is dead, is taking up the other end of the auditorium. Of course, it turns out not to be dead. It comes back to life and starts chasing and eating people. But that kind of silliness about it really makes it just a little bit different, a little bit of fun. It's one of those AIP movies from the late 1950s where Bert I. Gordon had a lot to do with it. So it's a lot of fun. Nothing too special. They used a lot of still photos of the Carlsbad Caverns for the cave in which they find and ultimately trap the spider, and that's done pretty well for that kind of physical effects. The acting is no better than you'd expect in this kind of movie, but nonetheless, it's kind of groovy drive-in fodder from the era, and a little bit of comfort watching, which is always a lovely and nice thing. By the way, if my voice sounds a little bit different than it does in the start of the podcast, that's because I've actually got the colonoscopy done. Yes, they knocked me out. I drank all of the nasty liquids I had to beforehand, which, to be indelicate, cleaned me out. And I went down, had the inspection done. They knock you out for about an hour, get the thing done, and then you wake up and have a glass of water and a couple of biscuits. And I got the all clear. So I don't have to do this again for 5 years. So that's kind of good news that my inner tubing is of high quality at the moment. So I just thought I'd let you know that to give you closure on the whole colonoscopy thing that's been ranging over the last two podcasts. It's a very unpleasant experience, not the thing itself because you're knocked out, but the preparation for it is kind of nasty. But back to the show. One of the other things I rewatched, which I probably might not rewatch again because it isn't as good as it should be, is this recent, or fairly recent, Luc Besson movie.
What happened? What did you do to my stomach?
What's going on?
We've merely slipped a new package into your lower tummy.
And you're going to transport something very special to us.
No.
You speak English?
Yes.
Take me to the hospital now.
Hospital.
Somebody put a bag of drugs inside me. I need you to take it out. It's leaking.
It is estimated most human beings only use 10% of the brain's capacity. Imagine if we could access 100%. Interesting things begin to happen. Yes?
Professor Norman, my name's Lucy. I just read all your research on the human brain. It's a little rudimentary, but you're on the right track.
Thank you.
I have access to 28% of my cerebral capacity.
I can feel every living thing.
Since when did you start writing Chinese?
Since an hour ago.
What happens when she reaches 100%?
I have no idea.
All this knowledge, you can unlock secrets that go beyond our universe. I'm not even sure that mankind is ready for it.
It's like all things that make me human are fading away.
Ah!
Yeah, but it's Lucy from 2014, starring Scarlett Johansson as a young woman who lives in Taipei in Taiwan, has a very dodgy boyfriend, and who ends up being recruited against her will as a drug courier. They insert the drugs into an incision in her stomach. Unfortunately, she gets kidnapped on the way to where she's going and gets beaten up, and the drugs start leaking into her system. It's a new designer drug, and it has the effect of increasing her intelligence exponentially. And she's got to try to find out what to do about it. She recruits Morgan Freeman's scientist, who seems to think we only use 10% of our brain, which has been discredited about 20 years ago. And she just basically turns into a killing machine and a super intelligent one at that, which is a lot of fun. That part of the movie is really fun. And one of the interesting things Besson does as well is he intercuts it with wildlife footage to just show the human beings are animals and to underline what he's doing with the rest of the movie. So he's playing a little bit experimental with the format of an action film in this case. And it's not too bad, but I don't think I need to see it again. It's a fairly complex, straight-through plot line, and there's not a lot there to generate a sequel. There's no purpose for a sequel on it. It's just one of those standalone action films that Besson does quite well. So I watched that. The next thing I saw was a documentary, which I really liked, in spite of the fact it was made fairly crudely and wasn't really done by professional documentarians. And it's a movie called VHS Massacre, Cult Films and the Decline of Physical Media, where a bunch of guys who are very much kind of physical media guys, they like VHS tapes, they like Betamax, they like DVD and Blu-ray, they love video stores, basically chronicle in their area in the northeast of the United States the decline of physical media and the decline of video stores and what that means to a community. I'm actually putting together a YouTube video about that very subject on why I think physical media are important in this age of video streaming. And I've done the narration for it, and now the hard part comes, finding graphics I can get away with using to demonstrate the narration that I do. But it's not a bad little documentary there. These guys have made some low-budget horror films themselves. They interview people like Lloyd Kaufman and Debbie Rochon and other people like that. And, it's a heartfelt passion piece, in a sense, and pretty good for that. One of the other things I watched, and I've been on a kind of bad movie binge by the look of things, and that is Ewan Allen's 1960 adaptation of The Lost World, Arthur Conan Doyle's novel about a land in South America where dinosaurs still exist, and a scientist called George Challenger goes there, and they have some adventures with dinosaurs and all sorts of cool stuff happens. I'll play the trailer because Ewan Allen is the schlockmeister of television in the 1960s. He did Lost in Space, he did Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, Time Tunnel, Land of the Giants, all of that kind of stuff. And eventually kind of lifted his game to do movies like The Towering Inferno. So he also had these grand ideas for doing movies, and the production values are pretty good in it. Nonetheless, there's always something a bit kind of stupid in an Ewan Allen production. But I'll play the trailer because it's got a fairly interesting cast. And it's in beautiful widescreen Technicolor, so you've got to like that. And it's one of those movies that I would have, I think I did really enjoy as a kid.
This is the greatest moment of your lives. There it is, directly ahead. A body of land uplifted by volcanic eruption 100 million years ago. The land where monsters live.
Yes, you're heading out of this world by jet airliner, by hydroplane, by helicopter, into the wildest of all jungles, into the forbidding headwaters of the Amazon with Michael Rennie, Jill St. John, David Hedison, Claude Rains, Fernando Lamas, and Frosty the Poodle as they discover a primitive world exactly the way it was at the dawn of time in the most fantastic of adventure stories.
For me, the story started 3 years ago when Burton White came to me. He told me of how in some Indian village out here in the jungle, he'd met a fever-stricken white man who babbled on about a plateau with monsters and diamonds.
Here is the most amazing of all possible worlds.
Oh! Oh! Johnny!
You'll see man-eating vines that lure their prey. Spiders as tall as trees. Oh! Hair-raising attack by prehistoric monsters. Battle of the Titans to the death. The most terrible creatures of destruction that ever walked the earth. You'll flee through grotesque underground mazes from cannibals who demand human sacrifice.
Sacrifice?
The place they undoubtedly plan to kill you.
No, not me, please, sir!
You'll be among the first mortals to cross the graveyard of the damned. You'll scale the incredible wall of death. You'll face the terrors of the Cave of Fire with its lake of molten lava, its fabulous pyramid of diamonds. And you'll be stunned by the horrifying 100-foot fire monster that guards a king's ransom in treasure.
Yeah, but it's one of the movies that says that it's okay to take a poodle with you when you go on an expedition to uncharted South America, because why the fuck not? There's absolutely no reason for Jill St. John to take a poodle with her, but they do that. And this has got all the tropes of the normal Irwin Allen movie and TV series. You've got to have one really cowardly character. In this case, it's a South American guy played by Jay Novello. You've got to have the heroic good guys. You've got to have a bit of love interest in there. You've got to have some peril. And it's just of its time to a deep extent. And I kind of like it and kind of hate it at the same time. Nonetheless, it was a bit of fun to rewatch it. But anyway, that's all I'm going to talk about what I've been watching. So I've extended that one a little longer than it normally goes in the podcast. And I'm going to talk about a much more interesting thing, which is the 2018 Netflix series Altered Carbon, based on the first of three novels by an English writer called Richard K. Morgan. And I'm going to play the trailer for that right now and then talk to you about why I liked it, in spite of what a few other people have said about it.
Your body is not who you are. You shed it like a snake sheds its skin. You transfer the human consciousness between bodies to live eternal life.
How long have I been down?
250 years.
You are the property of Bancroft Industries. You've been provided with this body, which came equipped with military-grade neurochem and combat muscle memory.
Mr. Kovacs.
I didn't ask you to bring me back into this world.
All I ask of you is that you solve a murder.
Whose?
Mine.
This is the beginning.
Whoever murdered him must be found, or we're all in danger.
I'm gonna need access that you don't want to give. And I'm gonna find answers that you may only think you want.
Friends, enemies, people with opportunity and motive.
Can't trust anybody.
If you don't solve this quickly enough,
I'll erase you. Of the end.
I thought you'd be bigger. They made me bring all this back up.
It's rude.
There's more here than you're willing to see. The mystery needs to be solved.
Hey, Lieutenant.
You know, saving your ass is not my only job.
I like her.
This is the beginning.
As I said, this is a 2018 Netflix series based on Richard K. Morgan's novels. It's based on the first novel. The other two are called Broken Angels and Woken Furies. And they're all set in the same universe, and they all have the same protagonist, Takeshi Kovacs, who's a half-Hungarian, half-Japanese guy in a distant future. It's 500 years in the future at the start of Altered Carbon. Now, this is where things get interesting, because in this universe, human consciousness is not in the human body. It's in a little disc that's implanted in your neck called a stack. And stacks are transferable into other bodies, which are known as sleeves. So if your body dies, you can be moved into another stack. So Kovacs, who was born on a world called Harlan's World, which is probably a Harlan Ellison reference, investigated that fully. And he's what they call an envoy. Now, in the novels, the envoys are very different. They're very much a military organization. But in the series, they're a bunch of rebels who are taught by a woman called Falconer to be almost superhuman in spite of whichever sleeve they're put in. It's almost like she's training ninjas, and these are the ninjas of the universe. So Kovacs died 250 years ago, and his stack was found and resurrected by a very, very wealthy man, a billionaire called Lawrence Bancroft, played by James Purefoy. Now, Bancroft is what is known as a Methuselah. He has the money to be able to clone his own body and have his stack moved into it when he dies, or whether by violent death or by his body aging. So he's basically got unlimited immortality, whereas normal people, because they're moved into stacks that aren't compatible with their bodies, there's a certain limit to the number of times that the stack can be moved into a new sleeve. And so there's a time limit, or at least a functional limit, on the immortality that most people have. Bancroft resurrects Kovacs so he can investigate Bancroft's murder, because Bancroft's previous self, before he uploaded his consciousness to a new stack, and one of the other virtues that the Meths have is if their stack is destroyed, they've got an offline backup, literally in the cloud, because it's in an orbital array, so that if they die, their consciousness can be downloaded into a new body and they're all happy. But Bancroft isn't, because his previous body, his previous sleeve with his previous stack in it, committed suicide apparently, and he thinks it's murder. He's convinced it's murder. He can't see any reason why, in the brief time between uploads, he would suddenly decide to kill himself. So he gets Kovacs to investigate this. Now, Kovacs is then in the Bay City that this is set, which is an extended futuristic San Francisco, meets up with a policewoman called Kristen Ortega, played by Martha Higuerita. He meets Miriam Bancroft, Lawrence Bancroft's wife, played by Kristen Lemon. And he decides that his base of operations is going to be a hotel called The Raven, which is run by an AI that thinks it's Edgar Allan Poe, which is kind of cool and kind of groovy. Problem with AI hotels, and this one hasn't had a customer in 50 years, is that they become emotionally attached to the customers, and a lot of people find that very cloying. But one of the things that the envoy train teaches Kovacs is that one of the things you've got to do in an unknown situation when you're dropped into a new city in a new world is build a bunch of alliances, and that's indeed what he sets out to do. So we do. There's a few issues to unravel here. First one is, you got Joel Kinnaman playing Takeshi Kovacs in most of the series, most of the 10 episodes of the series. And Kovacs is half Japanese, half Hungarian. But he's been downloaded into a very very European sleeve, because Joel Kinnaman is a Swedish actor, in spite of the fact that he often portrays himself as an American. He was born in Sweden. His father was American, but he was born in Sweden. His mother was Ukrainian Jew. So you've got that problem. Though there is a kind of, I think Netflix and the producers were very much aware of the stigma of whitewashing. And so we do get a whole episode plus a little bit extra where we see Kovacs in his original sleeve, played by an actor called Will Yun Lee. And that's kind of cool. I like that, because it does give us the sense that this is a guy who's in the wrong body. And one of the other things is they dumped him into a sleeve that's addicted to nicotine. So he's smoking and he doesn't like it. The other issue a lot of people have with this, and I personally don't, but some other people do, is the amount of nudity in the film. Now, there's a lot of nudity in the original books. I mean series. There's a lot of nudity in the original books. And one of the things the producers were going for, and they've actually talked about this, is they wanted to detach human consciousness from the human body in the minds of the audience. And by showing nudity, because a lot of the people in the movie are either billionaires or sex workers, so there's a natural increase in the amount of sexual activity and nudity in those particular realms of things, as we well know. And they wanted to detach that in the mind of the audience, the consciousness from the body, and to show the attitude to the human body has changed over the centuries, particularly given the fact that our consciousness is not our body. It's in this little hockey puck that's stuck in the back of your neck. And we do see a whole bunch of really interesting things that happen because of that change in technology. In one scene, as Kovacs is just getting used to his new body, we see that a young girl who's drowned is put into the sleeve of a middle-aged woman. And really, her parents come to pick her up, and she's in this middle-aged female body. And the whole family is shattered by this, because there aren't any other bodies available. Unless you're rich enough to have a buy a sleeve, the government gives you what they have available, and that's often a really inappropriate body. We also see this a lot later, when Kovacs hires and recruits a couple of hackers, one of which is a man, and the other one is another man, because the stack of his wife has been downloaded into a male body, and they've got to kind of try to negotiate their relationship until everything gets sorted out. And it gives us a beautiful complexity to characters. Sometimes the characters aren't who we think they are because they've been re-sleeved. Sometimes it's a useful thing, sometimes it's a tragic thing. So this world is very complex, but the nudity is there because A, we're talking about a milieu where there are a lot of sex workers, and B, the relationship to the human body is very much changed. And yes, that challenges a lot of the moral precepts a lot of people have now, but nonetheless, it's a really interesting way of doing it. Some of the nudity is sexual, particularly when Miriam Bancroft takes a run at Takeshi Kovacs. And also, but for the most part, it's very much not a sexualized nudity. And we get a few other interesting characters come in. We do get to see Kovacs' sister, Raylene, played by an Australian actor, Dietjen Luckman, who is of Tibetan and German ancestry. She was in Dollhouse. She was also in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. at one stage. And she's really good. She's very good at the action scenes. And as I've seen her over a number of roles, becoming increasingly good as an actor, she is a fine actor. And we get to see the relationship with Kovacs and her, and how 250 years of history has changed her as well, which is kind of interesting. We have a deeply and densely populated and
well thought out world on a budget of a Netflix series. This is a great looking piece of work. The cities are great. The rich people live literally in ivory towers above the clouds. There's a lovely texture to both the world of the rich and the poor in this particular universe, and for other worlds as well. And one of the interesting things is if they do the second and third novels as the second and third series of Altered Carbon, for the start, they're not going to have the same actor paint Takeshi Kovacs, Joel Kinnaman, because Kovacs gets re-sleeved in the second and third novels. So the cool thing about this is you're going to have three seasons of a product, Altered Carbon TV series. And the protagonist is going to be played by different actors by the very nature of the narrative. So that's going to be kind of cool. And I look forward to that. This is one of those interesting things that is happening now, like The Expanse, where novels are being adapted and maybe they don't get it perfectly well. And I think that Joel Kinnaman as an actor maybe doesn't yet have the skill set to hold down the role that he has in some ways. Nonetheless, I enjoyed it a lot. I do like a good bit of cyberpunk, and I think that this one definitely fills the bill. I wasn't expecting too much of it, but I was pleasantly surprised. One of the nice things too about having a Netflix style series is it's a natural format for novels. You can have complex narratives that you can't have in a movie. There's an old saying that movies are perfect for adapting short stories, but they're not that good at adapting novels. You've got to chuck out so much of the novel to make a feature film of it that the baby can be chucked out with the bathwater. But a series like this does have the room to tell the story of a novel without really shedding too much. I mean, there are some changes made from the novel to the Netflix series, but they're not particularly structural in some ways. The role of the envoys has changed in this one. There's also a scene where Kovacs is getting tortured in virtual reality, which is quite arduous and painful. And the ugly thing about it is you can just reboot and torture the person all over again, because every human being you see in this series is basically a consciousness in a little disc in spite of the bodies. In the novel, things were a lot harder because Kovacs was put into a series of virtual bodies, including a female person who was raped repeatedly. There's some very brutal stuff in the novel that just wouldn't play at all in any kind of audiovisual medium. And with the agreement of Richard Morgan, they changed those things to make it, to get the point across, but not get it across in such a harsh way that would seem and probably be gratuitous. There have been a few other things people complained about, the level of violence in there, and there is a lot of gory violence in this piece, but it's appropriate to the material. If you're going to tell a story in a very different and very non-somatocentric, you know, body-centric milieu as you have in this one, bodies are going to be seen as disposable and they're going to be disposed of. It's just the nature of the beast. With a plethora of material out there, if you don't like that sort of thing, you can definitely find other material, even in the science fiction genre, to watch. So complaining about something you're not going to watch and complaining about the way it's been done is a little bit of sniping from safe cover, in a sense. You've got no skin in the game. But I understand the need to not whitewash characters. In this case, it wasn't. It was a character who, by the very nature of the narrative, was whitewashed by the technology that enabled him to travel 250 years in the future. They could have well have cast an Asian actor to play the main Takeshi Kovacs, but that would be drifting from the narrative too much, I think. Even though Will Lee, who plays Kovacs in his own sleeve, is really good and is a much better actor than Joel Kinnaman, to stay true to the narrative, they had to have a white guy in there. And probably to get the eyes, they needed to have somebody who had some sort of profile and Kinnaman had that from things like Suicide Squad and from the unsuccessful RoboCop reboot of a few years ago. And that makes a complex question, is in that how far do you stray from the narrative and what's right? And is the voice of the crowd going to change the way movies are made based on previously existing source material? It's a bit like what the BBC does. The BBC puts people of colour into all of their products as a general principle. So they get actors of colour, they get writers, directors, set designers, everybody to do with the film. There's a certain amount of multicultural casting and employment that's done in for these particular series. But the problem is that in some cases they're doing historical series in milieus where there weren't people of colour. So I suppose that's a good thing in the sense that it's normalising people seeing people of other ethnicities when they turn on the TV, and seeing people of their own ethnicity when they turn on the TV. That's very important too. But from a historical point of view, it's a bit fucked. We change a lot of history, so it's probably all right from that sense. And I'm very much against whitewashing characters, because there are some really great actors out there, and there's some actors who need opportunities to become great that we need to give a go to. And unfortunately, in the past and the recent past, there have been cases where that doesn't happen. But what we need to do while we are watching that and trying to make the best movies we can that are inclusive is to make sure that we're not shooting at the wrong targets. And I think people who have accused this particular series of whitewashing the character are shooting at the wrong target. There are a lot of other things they can shoot at there. There are a lot of very Anglo TV series and movies out there, and we need to have not only people of colour as actors, but people of colour who bring their own culture and their own knowledge to the piece as well. That's one of the reasons why Black Panther is going to be such a powerful thing when it drops in a week's time, is that it's going to be the first real piece of Afrofuturism that we see in a cinematic form. But there can be some silly opinions about this out there, not just the racists, of course, but people who say, well, let's have a black James Bond. I think that you've got to kind of do something very careful here with cultural appropriation in reverse. Don't give us a black James Bond. Give us a black secret agent who is part of a black culture and who is at least as good as James Bond. One of the things people have talked about is, let's do a female James Bond. You've already got one. You've got Modesty Blaise there as a product, and if you throw the family enough money, they will let you make it as long as you make it properly. So don't just say, here's a white person in a role that's been traditionally a white person, let's make it a black person just to mix things up. No, do black stories. Don't do white stories painted dark. I don't think it's right for either side, really. And so this argument of whitewashing, yep, absolutely, where a character's been changed to be played by a white actor, definitely hit him on the head. But again, pick your targets with this kind of stuff, because you're going to scar and mark up things that just basically don't deserve it. So my final recommendation is, while Altered Carbon isn't perfect, it's solid. It's got a great mise-en-scene. It's got some great acting in it by actors who often don't get much of an opportunity, along with more experienced actors like James Purefoy. And it shows us a very layered, textured, detailed and ugly world of the future, which is, even with the technologies that develop, oddly believable. So that's about it this time around. I'm going to drop, as usual, the credits at the end of the podcast, but I'm getting a little bit exhausted. It's been a kind of rough few days with dietary restrictions and medical procedures and all sorts of things like that, but I promise to be more on the ball next time around. So anyway, look after yourselves. Watch good movies, watch bad movies, keep watching the skies, and I'll be back very soon with another Paleo Cinema podcast, and then with another Martian Driving podcast as well. Look after yourselves, okay? And here are the credits. Thank you to Tom the Focus Puller, Sarah the Special Effects Technician, Ian the Caterer, Grant the Technicolor Consultant, Claire the Script Doctor, Gary the Prop Master, Morris our Music Director, Jan our Dialect Coach, Armin our Key Grip, Matt our Rattlesnake Wrangler, Elaine our Scientific Advisor, Julia our Casting Director, Chris the Camera Operator, Christopher the Gaffer, Miss Jane the Wardrobe Mistress, Tansy our Foley Artist, Alyssa our Location Scout, Mark our Set and Unit Director, Paul our Special Makeup Effects Director, Tammy our Donut Wrangler, Tim our New York Unit Director, Rabbi Steve our Spiritual Advisor, Steve our Monster Effects Guy, Dylan our Goat Wrangler, Eric our Set Security Lead, Richard H the Set Photographer, Mark D Extra, David L the Extra, Richard C our Transportation Co-Captain, Carrie L our Tasmanian Consultant, and Kerry C our Accountant. We also have Sally our Continuity Girl, and of course the other Sally, who is always helpful and encouraging and wonderful. So thank you very much to all of the Patreon subscribers. You too can be a Patreon subscriber by going to patreon.com/paleocinema and donating as little as $1 per month.